Hey, I'm Ben Stiller.
I'm Adam Scott.
And we make a TV show called Severance. Severance is back for season 2 on Apple TV+.
Before the premiere, Ben and I are going to be binging season 1 and putting out daily recaps. And after that, we're going to keep going as we recap every episode of season 2.
The Severance podcast with Ben Stiller and Adam Scott is presented by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Listen and follow now on Apple Podcasts, the Odyssey app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Local news can come at you fast. Want the latest on what's happening in your backyard? Download the free Odyssey app. Follow your local news station, and you'll get alerts on the top stories making headlines in your city. You can stay in the know, no matter what you're up to, and be among the first to find out when news breaks. Plus, keep tabs on weather and traffic, so you're never caught off guard. To get started, download the Odyssey app. That's A-U-D-A-C-Y. And follow your local news station.
All right, here we go. A chilly Wednesday waiting for us. Not perhaps as chilly as yesterday was, but still chilly. And begs the question, why do I keep using the word chilly? I don't know. Maybe because it's chilly. Right now it is 47 degrees, going up to only 57. That's going to be toward the end of the day today. Tomorrow, highs of 59, 70% chance for showers. Then it clears out on Friday, highs of 64, and we go on a roller coaster, 70% chance for showers Saturday. Saturday is going to be a nice day, other than the rain, with highs near 70. So really, Friday, Saturday, those are the days you're going to want to take your cold preparations. Maybe Sunday, highs of 57, sunny. But then Monday, it turns cold. Highs Monday is only 40, 39 on Tuesday, 41 Wednesday, 46 Thursday. And a chance for freezes on the North Shore, maybe South Shore. And they don't quite know the timing of all of this. And they are actually talking about maybe a wintry mix. I don't know if it'll be here or maybe just up north in Yankee country in Baton Rouge, where we find Dr. Robert Hogan, professor in department and chair of political science at LSU. How you doing, Dr. Hogan?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
I'm okay. How's everything way up north there in Baton Rouge?
Oh, it's going very well. We're enjoying the winter, the 3 weeks of it that we usually get,
Exactly.
It feels like January for once.
Man, I was in Washington, D.C. 2 weeks ago. It felt like January there. I'll tell you what, it was freezing, literally freezing.
I bet so.
Reflecting pool was frozen solid and all that kind of stuff. And the whatever that pond is in front of Congress, the Capitol, rather, that was frozen as well. Let's talk about the confirmation hearings that are going on. And
sure.
Let's talk about the role of the Congress in all of this. We'll talk about the process and we'll talk some of the practicalities of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the Senate is tasked with receiving the designated people that the president would like to appoint to major cabinet posts. The president appoints all the major cabinet posts, 15 cabinet posts, including Secretary of State, Treasury, all the way down through education, agriculture, veterans affairs. And the way it works now, the Senate has to give its approval to these major heads of these cabinets, cabinet departments, as well as some of the people at second in command. He has the hiring and firing ability and needs Senate approval for about 1,000 people or so. And they're the people who control these departments. And there's always a tension. The president wants people who will do his bidding, so to speak, that accept his ideological perspective on the way these departments should be run. And so he wants people who will be loyal to him, but will hopefully do a good job in those positions. And Congress's responsibility, in this case, the Senate, a majority have to give their approval in the Senate, examine the nominees to confirm them, and they look at their backgrounds to see if they're qualified and see also if they will have fidelity to the interests of the departments that they're being asked to run. So there's always this inherent tension there, and Congress will most often, likely in the past, has done its responsibility of making certain that these are qualified people who are fit for these positions. So that's the way the system works. What's maybe very different this time is what you saw yesterday in the Congress, in the Senate hearings for the Trump's choice for the defense secretary, Mr. Hegseth. This was pretty unusual, I would say. I mean, a lot of the debate, or a lot of the questioning had to do with his issues of his character, of his personal failings, of his position on controversial issues. The Democrats went away from that, thinking this is not someone who's even qualified. And in fact, historically, you have to look. It's hard to find someone who is less qualified for defense secretary than this nominee. This is someone who has experience in the military, who has served in the military, the National Guard in Minnesota, but has never held any higher, level office in the military or rank in the military that we are accustomed to seeing previous designees or appointees have. There are legitimate questions about his judgment, his character, his qualifications, and Democrats were there as a loyal opposition to bring these things out, and the Republicans were there to try to provide support to their president's nominee. So we see this playing out, but I do think we're seeing something that's very different than we've seen in the past. Given his qualifications, it's like, well, why is Trump if you look at his other appointees, look at his appointee for Secretary of State, which is Marco Rubio, someone who has a long career in the U.S. Senate, a long career of service, who has built up expertise in foreign relations in the Senate. That nominee is not going to have any problem, and Democrats will be fully supportive of it. This is someone who I think Trump sees as a loyalist to Mr. Hegseth, and someone that will do his bidding. And a lot of Democrats are saying that's going a little too far. We want someone who has qualifications and can earn the respect of the millions of people that work for the Defense Department and who serve in combat. One of the key things here you got to consider is you want to appoint someone who will have the respect and can get things done. It is not a simple task to run an organization of this magnitude. And I think that there are real legitimate questions about whether or not he has the qualifications.
So when it comes to being a cabinet secretary, and I think a lot of people automatically fall into line of either winning or losing, you support President Trump, you're either with him or you're against him, and they support Pete Hegseth, and they don't maybe know about his qualifications. As Secretary of Defense, what will his job be?
So it's a new year, 2025, and you're thinking, how am I going to make this year different? How am I going to build something for myself? But where do I start? Shopify is how you're going to make it happen, and here's how. Shopify makes it simple to create your brand, open for business, and get your first sale. The best time to start your new business is right now. Get your store up and running easily with thousands of customizable templates, no coding or design skills required. All you need to do is drag and drop. Their powerful social media tools let you connect all your channels and create shoppable posts and help you sell everywhere people scroll. What happens if you don't act now? Will you regret it? What if someone beats you to the idea? Don't kick yourself when you hear this again in a year because you didn't do anything now. With Shopify, your first sale is closer than you think. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to start selling with Shopify today. Shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
Let's look at it from that angle.
Sure. I mean, it is to run the Defense Department. I mean, it is a multi-faceted task. It's running a large organization. It is dealing with budgets. It's dealing with all sorts of things that you deal with running a large organization. And the concern is that he doesn't have experience in doing that kind of thing. But it also has to do with providing he will be the person who speaks to the president concerning military options. Every sort of military possibility that is considered involves the Secretary of Defense. He is in charge of the generals. In the United States, we have civilian control of the military, and he is that person. He is the person in charge that tells the generals what to do, tells all of the military what to do. And so it is probably, I would argue, in the present day, the most critical of the cabinet secretaries. And, and the question is, do you want someone that is loyal to Trump? Or do you want someone who has the qualifications to know how to get the job done? What is so critical here, it seems to me, is that we're in a situation where Trump wants to have a disruptor in that position, okay? And Hedges himself even said this at the hearing yesterday. He's going to be a disruptor. The question is, you know, how do you balance someone who's going to be a disruptor with someone who can actually get something done? I think a lot of Democrats probably think or thinking to themselves, you know, let him appoint this person. This person will not be able to get anything done. He doesn't have the know-how. That sounds like a dangerous path in many respects.
Let me read two quick texts here, Doc, and then we'll take a break and come back. One of them says, what qualifies a senator who comes from a cattle ranching background or a senator who is formerly a family practice doctor to determine qualifications of a candidate seeking the position of Secretary of Defense or Secretary of Transportation, etc.? Another text says, Trump wants loyalists above anything else, doesn't care about qualifications. This will be another clown show where there's a revolving door of people in and out of these agencies and nothing will get done. That's a sampling of the texts I'm getting. You can send your thoughts in to the Oakland Art Jeweler Talk and Text Line at 504-260-1870. We'll talk about some other cabinet positions when we come back with Dr. Robert Hogan, Professor, Department Chair of Political Science at LSU, 623 Traffic Now, WWL. All right, 627 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Dr. Robert Hogan, Professor, Department Chair of Political Science at LSU. As far as process goes, the hearings are happening now. The inauguration is Monday. J.D. Vance gets sworn in as vice president on Monday. He would be the deciding vote in the Senate, correct? What's needed to confirm a cabinet secretary, Professor?
A majority vote in the U.S. Senate, and then the current breakdown is 53 Republicans to 47 Democrats. If there's a party line vote, the president will get all of his nominees confirmed. So that's why so much attention yesterday was put on the senator from Iowa, Joni Ernst, who sits on that panel.
You're reading ahead,
and what
Professor,
she was going to do.
That's what I wanted to get to in the next minute here that we have left. She's a survivor of sexual assault.
Right.
Pete Hegseth has been battling allegations of sexual assault. He says he was cleared of any charges, but she's up for re-election in 2026. So how afraid is she of being primaried? What kind of pressure, what kind of power does President Trump have, and how likely is that to affect this vote?
No, I think what you saw is you saw her capitulate. I mean, she brought up serious questions, and she said she was going to go into the committee with some serious and important questions. She did not go after him in a way that you would think she would. She came out yesterday saying that she was going to give him his support. So that effectively means that it looks like he has a glide path to confirmation. And not only it's her vote, but a lot of people were looking to her. There's still four or five U.S. Republican senators on the fence here. But they were probably looking to see what she was going to do. But there was a tremendous campaign in her own state. Potential candidates to challenge her sort of were saber rattling, saying that they were thinking of running. And there was, you know, a great sort of grassroots effort as well. So those things mattered. President Trump is extraordinarily powerful, probably the most powerful president the United States has ever had. And this is showing how that manifests itself.
They're going to hate me for asking you one more question at 6:30, but I gotta. And Professor, if you can be brief, please, to keep me out of trouble.
Sure.
But when it comes to a third of the Senate's up for re-election every 2 years, right? 2026.
Mm-hmm, right.
Does President Trump's power extend to senators that are not up for re-election in 2026 or not?
Well, I think so. I mean, a lot of senators who aren't up for re-election. They know that the voters have memories, and some of the other senators have other machinations about running for governor or higher office themselves. So, I think he has a lot of influence because he has a huge impact on party activists within his party.
Thank you, Professor. Appreciate your time. 6:30, time for WWL First News. 6:47, 13 till 10, Tommy Tucker, WWL, just about the middle of the month, 30 days after September, yes, right, just about the middle of the month, 31 days in January. Today is January 15th. It's going to be another chilly day with highs only going up to 57, and that's going to be kind of towards sunset. 60% chance for showers today, 70% tomorrow, And that rain's going to come in later on in the afternoon, they're saying, maybe even after tonight. So I don't know why they put that chance for showers in. It turns cold next week. Let's move on to Bo Jones, if we will, president and CEO of the Water Institute. How you doing, Bo?
Hey, good morning, Tommy. I'm doing well. How are you?
I don't know if that's your real name or not, but I'd hire you just for that name alone to be the CEO of the Water Institute.
It is indeed my name.
Let's talk about
Louisiana born and bred.
Let's talk about, I figured that. Let's talk about blue carbon, because I think a lot of people want to know, what is blue carbon?
Yeah, you know, appreciate the question, Tommy. I mean, basically, blue carbon is the ability of wetlands and you know, kind of water and aquatic habitats to pull down carbon out of the atmosphere and store it for time, right? And so, you know, Louisiana wetlands and wetlands around the world are critical ecosystems in, you know, as a part of the carbon cycle around the world. They pull down, you know, something like 30% of the carbon from the atmosphere. So
wait, take me through that again. I'm trying to get this straight.
So blue carbon, right, is a concept that everybody remembers, you know, back at Shaw High School, y'all talked about photosynthesis, right?
Right.
And so photosynthesis is the ability of plants to, you know, turn carbon dioxide into what they need and, you know, let oxygen go. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in coastal habitats, the wetlands that are all around Louisiana, the forests that are all around Louisiana, around the world, through that process, they are pulling down carbon out of the atmosphere and storing it in their roots and their woody material and in the ground. Wetland habitats, which make up about 3% of the planet, sequester about 30% of the world's carbon that is pulled down out of the atmosphere.
How does that compare and contrast with carbon capture as it's being presented or being developed?
Yeah, fantastic question, Tommy. You know, so carbon capture, as you generally hear it, or carbon capture utilization and storage, or direct air carbon capture, these are industrial-based solutions, right? Some technology that is either preventing carbon from going into the atmosphere or, once it's out there, pulling it back down. Mm-hmm. What we're talking about with blue carbon, and it's not just we, you know, scientists and policymakers around the world are navigating it, is how are we supporting and incentivizing the natural processes of plants and nature and nature-based solutions to pull down carbon, just like that technology. So forests all around the world are pulling down carbon. People are protecting forests for that reason, planting new forests. And what we're talking about here is in Louisiana and the Gulf Coast, what are the opportunities for protecting and building new marshland for that carbon benefit?
Is there any way to determine what kind of carbon gets captured by nature in total, not just blue carbon, but forest trees, et cetera? And I'm just trying to compare and contrast how nature can do, I'm guessing, Bo, and I might be wrong here, far more than any type of direct carbon capture could ever accomplish. Am I onto anything here or not?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, the question goes right to the core of the issue, right? Is that, you know, the carbon cycle is something that existed, you know, long before we created industrial processes, right? So the plant, the world has its own lungs. It has its, it sucks down carbon. It expels carbon. It cycles it through the oceans, right? So it is something that goes on. The system is complete without us. Now, when we've added things in, obviously we've had to augment things. But to give you a sense of scale, Tommy, right? So there's a lot of, you know, many of your listeners, you know, will get on a flight and the flight will say, you hop on a United flight and it says, your flight uses this much carbon dioxide. Do you want to offset that? Well, typically what you're doing is you're paying some fee to, you know, a forest around the world that is either protecting that forest from getting cut down and providing the financial support for that, or providing financial resources to plant new forests. In Louisiana, what the science has shown is that if you take 1 acre of a Louisiana wetland, right, and you compare that to 1 acre of a forest, a terrestrial forest, that the Louisiana wetland is about 80 times, sequesters about 80 times as much carbon, right? Wow. So there's a $2 billion-plus market in internationally around carbon sequestration naturally, and that's generally around forests. And what we're dealing with here in Louisiana and on the Gulf Coast is potentially on net an 80-time multiplier there.
So 80-time multiplier when it comes to capturing carbon, it restores the coast, it prevents coastal erosion, and also serves as for want of a better phrase, a breakwater when it comes to storm surge in times of hurricanes, et cetera, right? I'm on anything here, Bo?
Oh, you're right onto it, right? And that's one of the things, you know, when you go back to what you would traditionally hear as carbon capture or some of the industrial base, there's no unquestionably a carbon benefit, right? We're pulling carbon down or we're storing carbon. And one of the things that's really important that the state and the work that we're doing is, we've started under the Jindal administration, have done a lot of this work under John Bel Edwards, and we're continuing to do this work under Governor Jeff Landry. And what the state recognizes is exactly what you just hit on, Tommy, which is that there are multiple benefits for protecting and conserving Louisiana wetlands. I mean, you don't have to go far to know the aesthetic and the recreational value of them, how much we love being in and around the wetlands. But as you talked about the storm surge, the ecosystem services, and one of the things we're trying to do, and look, we're not an advocacy organization, but what we're trying to do is make sure that the full suite of benefits of Louisiana is not only recognized by, you know, your listeners who are you know, in the area, but internationally and nationally as well, to recognize that this is a comprehensive benefit.
Let me take a break. Bo Jones, president and CEO of the Water Institute. This seems like a no-brainer to me, so I want to come back and talk about where it stands now and how do you get more funding for it, because if you get 80 times the payback as you do on a rainforest, it would seem like this would be the way to go. 6:54, 6 till 7, traffic now, WWL. Less than a minute left with Bo Jones, president and CEO of the Water Institute here on WWL. 1 acre of wetlands can capture the carbon of 80 acres of rainforest. How, Bo, do you get this funded, this blue carbon project?
Yeah, you know, right now, the state of Louisiana and the federal government and industry around the state are investing heavily in the science and policy necessary to understand this. But, you know, I mean, I think one of the things that's important is that landowners and individuals around the state of Louisiana recognize that maybe the traditional notions of value for our wetlands, there may be more than we knew, right? And so in research we've done, we have found carbon in the soil in Louisiana wetlands that are between 1,500 and 3,000 years old, right? So these are incredibly valuable habitats for not only the people here, but for around the world. And I think it's important that people recognize that.
Hope you come back. Thank you.